It's Friday, October 23rd, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, I'll talk to a VOA reporter who was on the scene at former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's 11-hour congressional hearing into the 2012 Benghazi attack. We'll hear from our Pentagon correspondent about a U.S.-Iraqi rescue mission that led to the death of an American soldier. And we'll find out why there is so much hype revolving around the new Star Wars movie. It's all ahead on International Edition. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has testified as a sole witness in an 11-hour-long congressional hearing into the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. In Thursday's hearing, Clinton told a Republican-led congressional committee that she has lost more sleep than all of you put together over the attack that killed four Americans, including U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens. Here's an excerpt from Hillary Clinton's opening statement.
Despite all the previous investigations and all the talk about partisan agendas, I'm here to honor those we lost and to do what I can to aid those who serve us still. My challenge to you, members of this committee, is the same challenge I put to myself. Let's be worthy of the trust the American people have bestowed upon us. They expect us to lead, to learn the right lessons, to rise above partisanship, and to reach for statesmanship.
Well, Republicans allege that there are many inconsistencies in Clinton's account of what happened and what could have been done to prevent the incident. The Republicans also say previous investigations were not thorough enough. Well, our reporter Catherine Gibson was at the hearing, and earlier I asked her how much of it she saw.
It certainly was. I was there for the first portion of the day. I got there at about 9 a.m. To stake out a good spot where we could see Hillary Clinton arrive. And it was certainly very busy in terms of press there. So I needed to get a good spot at one of the press tables. It was a madhouse in the halls of Lawnworth. It was, you know, they were just able to keep things under control. The Capitol Police were there. There were media outlets from all around the world. There were people waiting in line to get spots. You needed to be ticketed to get into the hearing room. It was certainly a very lively, circus-like atmosphere.
So how lucky did you feel to be part of that?
You know, it was certainly interesting to observe that from the perspective of American democracy and how things work. It didn't seem like it was too ordered, but once Hillary Clinton got into the room, then it was very solemn and very quiet for quite some time.
Well, what was your impression over those several hours that you were there of Hillary Clinton's demeanor? How did she handle herself today?
She walked into the room like she owned it. And I think that was very calculated on her part. She walked in smiling. She walked in like she belonged there. She clearly, in her body language and her facial expressions, was not on the defensive. And in all of her statements, she always tended to bring it back to the tragedy of the death of the four Americans in Libya and what could be done from the American government's perspective to avoid that tragedy happening again in the future. So she really made a concerted effort to make it nonpartisan, to make it not about politics, and to look as though she was rising above the fray of this kind of chaotic, politicized hearing.
Well, given that that is the approach that Clinton tried to take, how does that compare to the approach of the Republicans and the Democrats on the committee?
Well, Gowdy, who's the chairman of the committee, opened up by saying that this was not about Hillary Clinton's emails. And that seemed to be an attempt on his part to make it look like the Republicans were not politicizing the issue. He made the point that, you know, they've had multiple tens of witnesses to before this committee, and only one of them had the last name Clinton. So he was trying to make it seem like the hearing was not about Hillary Clinton. that it was about finding out what happened in Benghazi. Obviously, on the Democrats' side, the Democrats mentioned how, multiple times, how ridiculous it was that Ms. Clinton had to appear before this hearing, before this committee. They said, you know, we've spent tens of millions of dollars, we've spent 17 months, do we really know anything new about what happened in Benghazi? And from a Democrat perspective, the answer is no, we haven't.
What were some of the key exchanges between Clinton and the Republicans and Democrats while you were there?
Well, Clinton certainly got into it at the end with Gowdy and a couple of the other congressmen from the Republican side about her relationship with advisor Sidney Blumenthal. You know, she received emails from Mr. Blumenthal, who has a long relationship with her and, and her husband, Bill Clinton. He was apparently advising her during her time as Secretary of State on issues relating to Libya. And Ms. Clinton characterized that as unsolicited advice that got thrown into the mix with all sorts of other information that she received as Secretary of State when taking into consideration issues in Libya. Of course, the Republicans felt differently about that and felt that, you know, here is this unpaid, unassigned advisor who's not in the U.S. government weighing in on matters of U.S. foreign policy. So there was a heated exchange about that. And the biggest exchange of the day, at least when I was there, was between Cummings and Gowdy, who are two members of the committee. And they got into a very heated yelling match over the purpose of the committee and what exactly was supposed to be going on in the room. And that was certainly the most tense moment of the day, at least as I saw it.
Well, why do you think the hearing today is so important in terms of U.S. politics?
Well, it was the first time that Hillary Clinton has appeared before this committee since it was revealed that she kept her emails on a private server and that she used a personal email account to, the Republicans would say, conduct State Department business. She contends otherwise. So this was the first opportunity formally for Ms. Clinton to address those issues. And certainly, you know, how that plays in the media and the American public may have bearing on her presidential aspirations.
And that was Catherine Gibson, our reporter, speaking to me earlier. Well, let's see what social media have been saying about the Clinton hearing. G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio. G., what have been the big hashtags related to the hearing today?
Hi, Michael. Hashtag Benghazi Committee is one of the trending hashtags worldwide, so it's not being just talked about here in America, but also around the globe.
So, G., we've heard a lot from the Secretary of State on social media since her appearance in the Democratic presidential debate earlier this month, and I would guess that her Twitter account has been sending out a lot of tweets today as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. The account at Hillary Clinton sent out 1 to 2 tweets every hour Thursday morning, but of course the tweets became more sporadic since the hearing began. Now, one of the tweets that's getting great response is this. We need leadership that puts national security ahead of politics and ideology. That particular tweet has been shared more than 1,000 times and marked as a favorite more than 1,500 times. Another popular tweet reads like this. As secretary, Clinton implemented reforms to protect diplomats and help prevent future attacks.
I see. Well, what about some other accounts tweeting about today's hearing?
Michael, not surprisingly, there are two main accounts and they have differing perspectives on the issue. First, there is @thebriefing2016, which calls itself the Benghazi hearing. The description says, everything you need to know about today's #Benghazi hearing in real time. Get the facts and help fight back against false attacks. The account mainly retweets supportive tweets from other users, but also shares links to interviews that back Clinton. One example is from her former colleague at the state, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, Wendy Sherman. She told USA Today that Clinton worked to ensure that American diplomats are safe.
Okay, so that Twitter handle is supportive of Clinton. What's the other account?
It's the official account of the Benghazi Committee. It goes by the handle @HouseBenghazi. Its pinned tweet is from June 25th, and it reads like this. State confirms Clinton failed to turn over all #Benghazi and Libya documents. That's been retweeted about 700 times. Michael?
Well, thanks, G, for that report. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, she is at G Abby Lee, and we're on Twitter too. You can find this program at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
We're very particular about detail.
Indonesians are known for their immaculate plane model replicas, and Marison, who goes by one name, has been making model airplanes since 1992.
This is my hobby because I grew up around an airport. I always saw airplanes landing and taking off.
Today, Marison's small company, Anglo-Indonesian Aircraft Models, outside of Jakarta, attracts business from around the world, holding its own against factory-produced models. Company partner Tony Jennings.
The Marison model are, generally speaking, much more detailed than competitor models. So that's why the business, I think, has expanded in recent years.
A competitive industry with strong demand, Marison pilots a staff of 30 with annual sales of $370,000 a year. The largest model maker in the world makes $10 million a year. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. A joint rescue mission by U.S. and Iraqi Kurdish fighters has freed about 70 hostages who had been facing execution by Islamic State militants. But in the battle in northern Iraq, one American serviceman was fatally wounded, the first member of the U.S. military to be killed in the year-long U.S.-led campaign against IS militants in Iraq. Earlier, International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke to our Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb and asked her what is known about that mission.
Well, we know that the U.S. forces who are advising and assisting in Iraq were asked to help out by the Kurdistan Regional Government. They said, we have this information. We know that there are dozens, and that we find out now that there were about 70 hostages that are under imminent death. All of the intelligence was telling them that it looked like there was going to be a mass execution. So dozens of the Kurdish Peshmerga forces and U.S. forces went in to free these hostages. It was in a prison facility by the Islamic State in Hawija. Now, Hawija is west of Kirkuk. It's not too far from Beji, which, you know, there's fighting going back and forth there between the Islamic State and Kurdish Peshmerga forces and Iraqi security forces. And they were able to go in and successfully rescue the hostages. As far as we know right now, there were none of the hostages killed. Five of the Islamic State terrorists detaining these were killed. Four Peshmerga forces were wounded, and we have heard that, unfortunately, one U.S. service member, as you said, was killed. There was a gunfire, and he was shot during that gun exchange. He was removed to Erbil and given some medical treatment, but unfortunately, he did not survive.
What is known about those the people who were rescued?
Not much at this point. We do know that about 20 of these rescued were members of the Iraqi security forces. Now, I've heard conflicting reports. We're hoping to get this straightened out in about 15 minutes when the Pentagon has a briefing. But right now, it's unclear who the other people were, whether or not they were Kurds or whether or not they were Iraqi Arabs. We do know, I've been told by a U.S. official, that none of them were Westerners. So these were Iraqis, be them Kurds or be them Arabs, that had been captured by the Islamic State.
And that was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. Well, the dreaded bubonic plague that wiped out more than half of Europe's population in the mid-1300s appears to have first afflicted people thousands of years earlier. VOA's Jessica Berman explains why in this report.
Danish researchers analyzed fossilized teeth of Bronze Age humans and discovered evidence of the plague 4,800 years ago, thousands of years before the disease wiped out between 50 to 60% of Europe's population. But the bacterium that caused the so-called Black Death was not nearly as aggressive during the Bronze Age, according to Simon Rasmussen of Denmark's Technical University. He helped analyze 101 fossilized teeth of individuals who lived in a region stretching from what is now Central Europe to the border between Russia and Outer Mongolia during the Bronze Age, which lasted from about 3000 BC to 1500 BC. Only 7 of the teeth from skulls dating between 2800 BC and 900 BC contained evidence of the plague bacterium Y. pestis, suggesting back then the bacterium did not spread as easily as it did later. Infected fleas now transmit the disease to humans, but apparently not during the Bronze Age.
So the plague in the Bronze Age is missing the gene that makes it able to survive inside the flea. So what we think is that the plague could actually not be transmitted by fleas back then.
The latest findings are published in the journal Cell. In a highly publicized paper a few months back, the Danish researchers reported on genomic studies suggesting the plague may have contributed to widespread disease that led to the decline of classical Greece and weakened the ancient Roman army. Rasmussen says the epidemics may also have led to a number of ancient mass migrations.
Still today, and also in the Middle Ages, if there were some kind of disease outbreak, then very often people would try to flee from it, to not be afflicted by this disease.
Bud Rasmussen says the migrants brought the disease with them to new settlements. Fortunately today, the plague remains a rare infection. Most recently, it struck in India in 1994, with almost 700 cases reported to the World Health Organization. With swift antibiotic treatment, Rasmussen says the plague is almost completely curable. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Anyone who has done a head count at a large gathering knows how frustrating and monotonous this task can be. Now imagine you're working for a large corporation or government agency and you need to determine how many people participated in an event that attracted thousands of people. The long and boring process usually involves people who examine aerial photos of the crowd. The photos may be overlaid with a grid of cells a couple of centimeters square. Then, one cell at a time, the counters tally the number of heads per cell. Researchers at the University of Central Florida have now come up with an automated crowd counter. The software they created allows a computer to scan aerial photographs and then count the number of people in the images automatically. The software creators say that what had taken a week to complete can be done in as little as 30 minutes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Well, there's been unprecedented interest in the latest Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens, which opens in theaters in North America on December 18th. Early ticket sales are record-breaking, amounting to at least $6.5 million, and that figure comes from the IMAX theater chain. The third Force Awakens trailer, a 2.5-minute movie clip, made its TV debut during an American-style professional football game on October 19th, and it was watched by almost 16 million people. Well, senior media analyst Paul Durgarabedian of the firm Rentrak told VOA's Victor Beatty that he has never seen such anticipation for a movie in over 20 years of tracking Hollywood.
We're anticipating opening weekend numbers that could certainly post records for the month of December, but could also post some of the biggest box office grosses of all time. And for the opening weekend, if we have anything north of $208.8 million in North America, anything north of $600 million worldwide, we're looking at records there. And then beyond that, on the worldwide scale, this could be a $2 billion movie plus. So there's a lot of anticipation, a lot of excitement, and this could culminate in some of the biggest grosses we've ever seen in box office history.
Surpassing movies like
Avatar, Titanic, the Hunger Games movies. You've got the Harry Potter films. This is a film that is in such great company in terms of some of the top-grossing franchises of all time. And interestingly, we've got a lot of big franchises on the way this year before Star Wars even hits theaters, and that could build momentum. For instance, the final Hunger Games installment, Mockingjay Part 2, opens in about a month, and then after that we have the James Bond movie Spectre, and then a month after that we have the Star Wars The Force Awakens movie, which I think is going to be just tremendous for the box office and for theaters this year.
Paul, aside from early ticket sales, there's also a sign that social media has taken great interest in this new Star Wars series.
Well, this is the first Star Wars movie to have this social media component. You know, there wasn't social media when the last film was released back in 2005. And so now this adds a whole new layer of excitement, but also the ability for fans to talk to each other on a global scale via Facebook, Twitter, all the different platforms that enabled people to get the word out about movies that they love. And I'm telling you, the people who see this movie first are going to be setting the stage for all the conversations on social media that come after them. And that's why a lot of people have already bought their tickets for that preview night, which is on December 17, and of course for December 18 in that opening weekend for the movie. So social media, a big part of the success of this movie already leading up to the film in terms of its exposure, but then the box office success is going to come once the movie opens. And already they've sold a lot of tickets online and sold out a lot of shows, and this is 2 months before the movie is released.
Well, a sociological question, what is causing all this excitement, do you think?
That's a big question, Victor. I think it really comes down to a legacy of this movie being part of a lot of people's formative movie-going experience. That first Star Wars movie, it opened May 25, 1977. And that first Star Wars movie was a phenomenon at the time. And people feel like this movie is part of their family, these characters, this franchise, the brand itself. And now under the Disney umbrella, it has an even broader potential for co-branding at the theme parks, for merchandise, for the international box office, and of course down the road on home video. So this is a decades-long play for Disney, who's bringing that Lucasfilm legacy to bear and bringing all of their marketing muscle to create what could be one of the biggest movies of all time.
Well, being a Star Wars fan myself, I guess I better get my act together and get some tickets soon for that new film. And so you're listening to Paul Dergurabedian there, and he was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. British singer-songwriter Ed Sheeran has a new movie out that brings together his performances last July at London's Wembley Stadium and behind-the-scenes footage of his X tour. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the 24-year-old Sheeran's new movie was beamed to special theaters worldwide this week.
Ed Sheeran says in his film Jumpers for Goalposts that every wish he has made in the past 5 years has come true. For fans who couldn't make his sold-out shows during the X Tour, Jumpers for Goalposts could be a dream come true as well. The film includes footage from Sheeran's performances at Wembley Stadium in July and includes a special duet with Sir Elton John.
Reality's hit, and you're like, I have to play to 240,000 people.
Ed Sheeran says that he wanted to make a concert film for one reason, so other people could see it.
I don't know. I just find that whenever I'm on a British Airways flight, I always watch someone's concert film, and it always, like, I was never really a fan of Justin Bieber, and then I watched Never Say Never, and it made sense. So I was like, oh, I get it now. So I wanted to make a film that I could put on British Airways flights and have Chinese businessmen like my music.
The film was shot over 3 nights with 80,000 people jamming the stadium for each performance. Sheeran says he wasn't nervous about the documentary crew catching any mistakes he made.
I wasn't too nervous about the recording of the show. I was nervous about the show because there were so many people there, but I wasn't too nervous about the recording of the show because we did three nights there. So I was like, I know if we mess up something tonight, we can do it tomorrow. And I know if we mess up that, then we can do it the next day. So whenever I messed up a song, I was always like, okay, tomorrow I'll make sure that that little bit I get perfect and then they can cut in between.
I think this is the most important milestone so far. This is real people buying real tickets to sit on seats with 8,000 other people to come and watch me play.
Ed Sheeran's second studio album, X, has sold more than 705,000 copies so far this year. That's better than his friend Taylor Swift's 1989 and Sam Smith's In the Lonely Hour. Though Swift said earlier this year that she would not allow her music to play on the online streaming service Spotify, Ed Sheeran credits the service for boosting his popularity and his income.
You know, I can go to Norway and Iceland and Thailand and just like random places where CD sales are not prevalent. I think I've sold like 2,000 records in Norway, but the album, I don't know how many times it's been streamed, but it was number one for like 48 weeks there, just on Spotify. So it's Spotify for me, it works, and because I am a touring act. But I think the conversation with Spotify is more for new upcoming acts and writers. I think that's where the revenue should go. But I think when you're a big touring act, you use it to your advantage.
Jumpers for Goalposts had its world premiere at London's Leicester Square October 22nd. It will continue in selected theaters through October 25th. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Well, a friend recently told me that I should check out Spotify, so I think I'm going to finally download it after this show. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. It was brought to you today by director Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Chung. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you'd like to find me on Twitter, I am at Michael_Lippin. And once again, please follow our show on Twitter and send us a message, and we'll write back to you. You can find us at VOA_IE. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great weekend.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.